Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. This is AB Dawji and this is The Big Picture, broadcasting simultaneously on Radio Islam and Radio Al Ansar. Yes, The Big Picture, where we keep track on the Chorwan virus, giving you the latest statistics on new infections, how many of them have breathing problems and sleepless nights, and how many got a lucky jab from the hawks. The Big Picture, where we shine the spotlight on the mamparas, the mukhus, the laddus and the aloos, and the assorted cockroaches who crawl around looking for new ways to cause chaos on this earth. Yes, The Big Picture, where we puncture the gas bags full of hot air and deliver some well-deserved kicks up the rear of the fat cats and dirty dogs that suck the blood of hard-working, decent, respectable people. And they come in various categories. Almost at the top, if not at the top of the list, are most politicians. And yes, it's that season again. Ta-ta-da-da! It's election time. Once again, dear folks, we are in the promised land. The promised land. Vote for my zigzag party and I will... Well, I promise to give you all free houses, free electricity and free water. And I promise to get rid of all crime. And I promise that not one cent will be lost to corruption. And I promise that food prices will come down to what they were 30 years ago. Potatoes will be 5 rands a pocket. I promise. And I promise that there will not be a single pothole on any road in South Africa. Petrol will be free, and I promise that if you elect my party, we will pay for your holiday to go to Zanzibar with AB Dawji. Yeah, I'm going to vote for that party. Yes, folks, the promised land. Hallelujah! How nice they look, eh? Smiling at us from posters on light poles. After you vote for them, then you are up the pole. They remember you so well at this time. So well at this time. They even call you. Hello, have you been registered to vote? Well, if you did, then don't forget to vote for us, the Bajja Party. We promise to put a chicken in every pot and a block of butter in every fridge. Vote for us. Thank you. Yes, they remember you so well, like as if they are your close connections, and then immediately forget you once you put your cross against their name. Fed up, that's what I am. And so many of the same smiling faces keep popping up. What is that popular expression? Politicians and babies' nappies must be changed very often, and both for the same reason. Hey, politicians and babies' nappies must be changed very often, and both for the same reason. Did you get that one? Did you get that one, Mamu? Hey, don't worry, your fro will explain it to you, right? So thank you, dear listeners, for tolerating my ranting. I feel much better now. So let's begin with some light stuff-ish. But, you know, this election circus is still lurking in my mind. Last week, Iraq had parliamentary elections. An independent candidate, a lady by the name of Ansam Manuel Iskandar, won one of the 5 seats allocated for the Christian community under the quota system. Isn't that wonderful, eh? Wonderful, they got a quota system so minorities can also get a seat in parliament. And she managed to get 2,397 votes. But guess what? She won't be going to parliament. And the reason is, because she is dead. That's right. Kheer and alugos, that's what they served at her funeral. She died 2 months ago. On the 24th of August. But her name was on the ballot paper and people voted for her. My dear erudite, discerning, eloquent listeners, hey, I sound like a politician there, buttering you all up. Which reminds me of what one buddy told me. It's so cold that I saw a politician with his hands in his own pockets. Hey, I should stop picking on politicians. There are some really good ones out there. I know them. I know some of them. And I hope the Senator's party does well. Now, there's a clue that you need to follow, okay? Okay, what was I speaking about just now? Ish, you know what? You people like to distract me. What was it? Ah, yes, the lady in Iraq who died and was elected to parliament. Please listen to this explanation and see what you can make, whether you can make sense of it. Right? In a Facebook post published on her page by her family, they confirmed that she died on the 24th of August after being infected with the coronavirus. They also responded to the angry comments by users of Facebook, saying that they allowed her to be elected in order to immortalize her. This is what the family said when they got the angry comments. They said that they elected her in order to immortalize her, and they believe in her and their unwillingness to have their votes in vain. The family insisted that even though some did not know about her death, she was, in their words, she was elected because she has a valuable career in the field of work and cooperative path in the field of humanity and stands by the youth. They justified Iskandar's continued candidacy by referencing her great impact on the youth, and especially due to the fact that she did not have any electoral propaganda or a picture hanging in the street or an advertisement on Facebook. What does that part? They believe in her and their unwillingness to have their votes in vain. What? What are they talking about? Are these people smoking something? Casting a vote for her is not in vain, meaning it's not useless. Habibi, the lady is underground. The lady is underground, pushing daisies, as they say. How can she do anything to help the people? But wait, Ghulam Bhai from Mir Bank is always very cross. He's like fed up, generally around this time, especially at election time. He removed his dartboard in his garage and replaced it with one of the pictures on the light, one of those posters on the light poles. The red one, you know the red one? Yesterday I told him about the dead auntie elected to parliament, and he let out a very dirty laugh and he said, "Hey, Baji, half the O's in our parliament look like they are dead, catching a killer dose and snoring loudly. One O woke up with a shock when the speaker shouted, 'Order, order!' And he quickly said, 'Give me a quarter beans bunny and a Coke.'" Hey, this Ghulam is a character. Anyway, dear listeners, let's leave politics and enter into the world of love and romance and relationships. So tell me, do you know what is true love? Anyone out there? Well, maybe let's see when your fro laughs uncontrollably at your dry jokes that she heard a million times over. That's true love. Or after you have eaten one dozen samosas, she still leaves the last one for you, although she's just only ate one other one. Yes, that's true love. I asked Ghulam Bhai this question, and he said he's very romantic. That's what he told me. He's very romantic. He told his wife, "My love for you..." Gulamba is a character. He told his wife, "My love for you is like diarrhea. I can't keep it in." I'm not sure whether his wife was impressed with that declaration of love. So, why am I bringing up this issue of what is true love? Well, the best way to show your love is usually maybe with a box of chocolates that you bring home or some flowers. But one fellow went out of his way to show how caring he is. What a guy. For this story, we go all the way to Bosnia. and 72-year-old Vojin Kusik. He was tired of his wife constantly complaining that she doesn't like the view from their house. She doesn't like the view from their house. So what did he do about it? He built a new house for her on a big rotating platform. That's right, you know, like the glass plate that you have in your microwave. And let me read to you. Listen to this. Situated on a fertile plain in northern Bosnia near the town of Srbac, the house spins around a 7-meter axis designed by Kusik with a view of cornfields and farmland, changing to forests and the river at a desired speed. And he says, the house can make a full circle for 24 hours when it's at the slowest speed, whilst at the fastest spinning, it can make a full circle in 22 seconds. Yes. Hey, the whole house can turn around completely in 22 seconds. Hey, that buddy must be trying to make his throat dizzy so she can go and sleep and stop chowing his brains. What a guy. Shah Jahan only built the Taj Mahal after Mumtaz died. This fellow built a house to please his wife while she's still around. Eh? Magic stuff. Eh? True love, Habibi, true love. I wonder how Ghulam Bhai from Mirbank would respond if his wife told him, darling, I don't like to see those big towers from the petrol company blowing all that black smoke. He'll probably say, why don't you close the curtains and go and sit and read Quran or something, eh? Hey, shh. The age of romance is gone, Mamo, gone. Okay, let's change gears. You know what? In life, there are some things that are crystal clear, and no amount of spin doctoring, no amount of whitewashing can change what is perfectly obvious, perfectly clear. Yesterday, Rosemary Ndlovu was found guilty of organizing the killing of a whole lot of people, and that was between 2006 and 2012, to collect insurance money, which was over 1.4 million rand. She was responsible for the murders of her sisters, of her sister, right? Her sister's son, her partner with whom she had a child, her cousin, her niece, and another relative. She also tried to get another sister killed, and also her mother, but somehow that failed. And of course, she took out the insurance policies with her as the beneficiary. And in court, she actually pleaded not guilty. Absolutely amazing, eh? Clearly, it was an open and shut case. And so that was crystal clear why she did it. Right, so... And so also, it's very clear with our Yakubai. Zuma says that he is innocent of any and all charges of any type of corruption. Well, in the public, in their minds, one thing is clear, that Zuma, as president, allowed the Guptas a free-for-all as far as state assets were concerned. The evidence at the Zondo Commission clearly shows state capture. State capture. So what is clear is that Zuma's plan is to do two things. Firstly, and this is my view, okay? Firstly, what they've already done is to show that the whole judicial system, well, they've tried to do that, to show that the whole judicial system is corrupt and judges, including those in the Constitutional Court, are biased. You've heard them saying this, right? Secondly, they are going for Zondo himself. And the close buddy of Zuma, Arthur Fraser, who was until recently the Commissioner of Correctional Services, declared that Zuma should be out of prison on medical parole. Of course, providing no evidence. He just said, right, it's my job, I can do it. I have the right to do it, and then Zuma must come out of jail. And this week, Fraser fired another shot at Zondo. the term of the Chief Justice, Mokgeng Mokgeng, who was head of the Constitutional Court, came to an end about a week or two, ago. So a new Chief Justice of the court has to be nominated or established. Many judges have put their names forward, including Raymond Zondo, but Arthur Fraser objected. This is what he said. In a letter, Fraser said Zondo was not a fit and proper candidate to head South Africa's top court. He complained about the way he was treated by the State Capture Commission chaired by Zondo. And these are his words. I have reason to believe that his conduct was deliberate and sought to protect those I have exposed to be the real culprits in capturing or attempting to recapture the state. I further have reason to believe that this deliberate conduct by Zondo sought to protect the real origins of the idea of the commission as a foreign-sponsored concept. So Fraser is saying that Zondo is not fit to be a judge, let alone the Chief Justice of the highest court in the land, the Constitutional Court. So what is all this about? And again, I want to say, here is my view, and of course I could be completely wrong. There is a full-scale attempt now to destroy the reputation and credibility of both the judiciary and Zondo, making them out to be incompetent and biased, so that when the report of the Zondo Commission comes out, perhaps early next year, indicating that Zuma was in fact allowed the state to be captured by the Guptas, then the people will say, nah, that's just a load of rubbish. It's all lies because Zondo was Zuma's enemy, and so on and so on and so on. So, you know, it discredits Zondo right now, so that people will say the report is hopeless. And for me, what is the crystal clear strategy? This is the crystal clear strategy. Let's not forget that Zuma tried to get Zondo removed from the commission and subsequently refused to appear, and therefore ended up in jail for contempt of court. And now Fraser got his boot in also. And now they are giving, they're going for Billy Downer, who is the chief prosecutor in the National Prosecuting Authority. He is to lead the case against Zuma for the allegations of bribery in the French arms deal saga, if you remember that one, where Zuma was alleged to receive 500,000 rands for protecting the arms, the French arms dealer, from investigation of corruption. So on Thursday, Zuma laid criminal charges against Billy Downer. The Downer had illegally leaked Zuma's report on the condition of his health. He leaked it to a journalist. And so he wants Downer to be prosecuted and ultimately removed as the chief prosecutor, and thereby also to get Zuma acquitted, right? This is the strategy to get Zuma acquitted. So that's a developing story. But as I said, some things are crystal clear. And that, dear listeners, is the theme of today's discussion, my dear learned, sagacious friends, whatever that means. Right, so let's look at something else that's crystal clear. Afia Siddiqui is a name known to you. Here's what is clear, and that is that she's a victim of America's injustice. You know, I'll never forget another such victim about whom I spoke extensively way back in the 90s. And that is about Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman, a blind Maulana from Egypt who spoke out against the Egyptian regime and was repeatedly tortured. I read one report that he was tortured in, I'm talking about in American jails. He was hanged upside down. Not in American jails, in Egyptian jails. He was hanged upside down, beaten with sticks and given electric shocks. Anyway, somehow he managed to make his way over to United States, but he was still pursued, targeted by the Egyptian regime, and eventually charged. It's quite a story, this one. He was charged for planning terrorism and sentenced in 1995 for plotting to kill Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Hey, man, can you imagine this? A very, very sick, blind old man, got heart problems, suffering from chronic diabetes, and he was falsely accused. And he died in jail in February 2017. A horrifying story. Horrifying story. And so is that of Afia Siddiqui. Here is some background. Here is some background to this case. Siddiqui, a U.S.-educated Pakistani national, was charged with attempting to kill U.S. soldiers and FBI agents during interrogation after arrest in 2008 in Afghanistan, Ghazni province. I remember when they interrogated, they said that she grabs one of the agents' guns and was trying to attack them, and then they shot her. They shot her in the stomach, and she was in critical condition for a long time. I don't know what's her condition now. Anyway, she was flown to the United States and sentenced to 86 years in prison after a New York court found that the 49-year-old mother of three guilty of attempted murder and assault in 2010. Siddiqui earned her undergraduate degree from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1995 and a doctorate in neurosciences from Brandeis University in Boston before moving back to Pakistan in 2003. According to her family, Siddiqui and her three children were abducted by the Pakistani intelligence agencies immediately after her return. In 2008, she appeared in Afghanistan. Right, so she disappeared after she was abducted. In 2008, she appeared in Afghanistan and was detained by the Afghan police under suspicion of planning a suicide bomb attack and in being in possession of notes on how to make chemical weapons and dirty bombs, accusations denied by the family and lawyers. Currently, she's been held in Federal Medical Center prison in Fort Worth, Texas. Well, I told you that Afia is a victim of U.S. injustice. Muslims and non-Muslims around the world also believe this. And on Wednesday, dozens of protesters and human rights activists demonstrated outside the Pakistani consulate in New York, calling on Prime Minister Imran Khan to actively seek the immediate release of Afia and take her back, repatriate her to Pakistan. And this whole demonstration was organized by a coalition of 20 local and national human rights and religious groups, including the Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE. It's one of the top bodies in the United States that fights Islamophobia and fights for the rights of Muslims who have been unjustly charged or imprisoned. And Mus'ab Sadiera, a 21-year-old member of the Islamic Leadership Council of New York and one of the organizers of the New York protest, said Siddiqui is a victim of the U.S.'s so-called war on terror and, in her words, unjustly imprisoned. She is a prisoner of conscience, a political prisoner, and victim of the U.S. war on terror. We are here to tell the Pakistani government to stand up for its citizens and secure her freedom. And then there's another person, very well-respected author and prominent anti-war activist, Sarah Flounders. And she has followed Siddiq's case for more than a decade and believes she is innocent. And Sarah says she is a victim of secret rendition. I attended her court trial. It was just a show trial and a theater of war on terror. The U.S. government should immediately free her and reunite her with her children. Sarah Flounders. Well, dear folks, a show trial, meaning that clearly she's a victim of American injustice. Okay, here's another case of American injustice. And this also happened some years ago, but it wrecked the lives of very prominent, very respectable, decent, law-abiding Muslims. Very, very prominent and very decent, respectable people. Right. Another case of a crystal clear example of American injustice. There was a huge humanitarian organization in the United States that assisted many suffering people, but more especially the Palestinians. Very respectable, as I said, like Al Imdad or Gift of the Givers. The organization was the Holy Land Foundation, but anti-Palestinian Zionist groups were not happy with the work that the Holy Land Foundation was doing in easing the suffering of the Palestinian people. By the way, this whole story is covered in great detail by a man for whom I have the greatest respect and admiration. His name is Mikko Peled. He was here in South Africa maybe 2 years ago. He was born in Jerusalem and is the son of a former general in the Israeli army. He now lives in California and is an outspoken critic of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. He is what is described as a truth teller, a truth teller. And I admire him because it's very difficult to stand up and speak out against your own people when they do wrong. Very difficult. We here in South Africa had many whites who stood up against apartheid. Mikko Peled wrote many books on apartheid Israel. And then he's got one entitled Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Injustice, the Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5, published in 2018. Let me read from an article that Mikko Peled wrote just in this past week. And in there he says, now listen very carefully. He says, in my book, I tell the story of five innocent men who were wrongfully accused, tried and convicted for providing material support to a terrorist organization. If they were guilty of anything at all, it was caring more for their fellow humans than they did for themselves. The five men went through two trials and in the end were convicted and sentenced to sentences of 15 to 65 years in federal prison. The men are Shukri Abu Bakr, sentenced to 65 years. Hassan Ilashi, sentenced to 65 years. Mufid Abdul Qadir, sentenced to 20 years. Abdul Rahman Ode, sentenced to 15 years. And Mohammed El Mizain, sentenced to 15 years. 15 years are almost up, and two of the five men are up for release. Abdul Rahman Ode is finally at home in Dallas, albeit living with the restriction of a released felon. That means a criminal, right? Restricted. Mohammed El Mizain was supposed to be released, but because he is not a naturalized citizen of the United States, rather than let him go to his family in America, the authorities released him, in inverted commas, to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, possibly for deportation. Right, let's talk about the Holy Land Foundation. Once the largest Muslim relief organization in the United States, the Holy Land Foundation, the HLF, was shut down after the 9/11 attacks by President George W. Bush via an executive order. After the attacks of 9/11, the U.S. government wanted to show that it was acting swiftly and effectively against terrorism. So the Treasury Department was instructed to find and close down operations that were funding terrorism in the United States. In his book, The Prince of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill, published in 2014, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ron Suskind describes the post-9/11 atmosphere in Washington as one of round up the usual suspects. The Holy Land Foundation, being a Muslim charity with a focus on Palestine, was a prime target. In addition, since the early 1990s, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, which is an anti-Palestinian Zionist organization, had engaged in a smear campaign against the Holy Land Foundation, along with American Zionist politicians like Chuck Schumer Anthony Weiner and others, the ADL was claiming that the Holy Land Foundation was funding terrorism. The smear campaign against the Holy Land Foundation was working even before the attacks of September 11, 2001. As the defendants learned during the trial, the FBI had been tapping some of their phones since 1990s. Furthermore, the campaign was hurting the relations Holy Land Foundation had with other organizations, and in some cases, important alliances had been brought to an end as a result of false accusation. On December 4, 2001, the President of the United States declared that he had closed down, in his words, a major terrorist funding network, and the Holy Land Foundation was designated a terrorist organization by the U.S. Department of Treasury. The process of so designing an organization, the process of so designating or declaring an organization or an individual requires little due process. You don't have to go to the court or anything. Far less than what is required in a court of law. Right. In accusing the Holy Land Foundation of funding terrorism, the government has a series of problems. While President Bush rushed to declare them a terrorist organization and declared that closing them down was somehow a great achievement in the fight against terrorism, the fact of the matter was that he had no proof. The officers, the people of the Holy Land Foundation, kept impeccable accounts, and every penny that went through the organization was accounted for. No money had gone to any terrorist organization, not one single penny. Most of what the foundation was giving away was in kind, right? Not in money. They were providing school supplies, food, medicine, along with a relatively small number of schools, scholarships that were paid directly to educational institutions. So you see, no money went to any terrorist organization at all. No money or goods ever went from the Holy Land Foundation to any organization that was not recognized and approved by the U.S. government. Did you get that? Hey, money only went to organizations that were recognized and approved by the U.S. government. The groups and organizations with which the foundation worked on the ground in Palestine were not only vetted or cleared by the CIA, they were also receiving funds and goods from other U.S. and international relief organizations. Wow, isn't that amazing? So everything was above board. So in order to make a case that would convince a jury that the foundation was actually supporting terrorism, the U.S. government falsified evidence, presented documents that were wrongly translated from Arabic, and even allowed two Israeli nationals to testify as expert witnesses anonymously. No one knew who these witnesses really were and whether or not what they were claiming was true. What was obvious through reading the trial transcripts is that the lawyers for the foundation made it clear that these witnesses knew very little and that their claims were untrue. Can you see that? Can you see how this was just a show trial and mainly pushed very strongly by the anti-Palestinian and pro-Zionist groups in the United States? Right, so to discuss, let me just see now, where am I? Right. So, listeners, I was following the trials of Sheikh Umar Abdul Rahman and the Holy Land Foundation very closely at that time. And I was horrified, that innocent Muslims were called terrorists. Anyway, I was deeply touched by what Miko Pellet said in the last few lines of his article that he wrote last week. He says, sorry, I met Abu Ibrahim, is one of the people who is still in prison, twice while he was held at the federal facility in Long Beach, California. I knew he was the elder or the oldest of the five and that he was not in the best of health. However, the man I met was not weak and frail as I had expected, but strong, full of life and determined. I saw a proud man with a strong handshake, who was proud of who he was and proud of the important work that he had done with the Holy Land Foundation. What the future holds for him is uncertain. It is unclear when or whether the U.S. government will allow him to be united with his family again. What is clear is that the imperatives of the U.S.-Israel relations had corrupted not only the political system in the United States, but also the judicial system. Right, so there you are, listeners. How horrible it is that people's lives are shattered, families deprived of their fathers, and men not able to embrace the warmth of their families. How very sad and tragic. A curse on those who inflicted such suffering and harm on innocent people. And so, the so-called West and its allies in the Middle East claim to be custodians of good values, civilized values, human rights and justice. Makes me want to vomit. And let's look at one other issue. Over the past 100 years, where did dictators in Africa and elsewhere and corrupt politicians from all over the world hide their massive amounts of loot, stuff that they stole? They either secretly bought hugely expensive properties in the West or deposited them mainly in Western banks. Here is a question. Where is the capital of South Africa? And the answer is Dubai, eh? Let your fro explain that to you, Mamo. A few weeks ago, we heard about the Pandora Papers, an expose about wealthy people putting billions away in secret overseas accounts. As I said, this is very clear about rogues milking a country and hiding money, billions that could uplift the citizens of that particular country. Here's another clear issue that I was going to speak about, but it's a long story, Kashmir. Yesterday, October 22nd, is discussed all over India as Black Day of Kashmir, or also as Black Day for Pakistan. Commentators said that it was the day that Pakistan forces invaded Kashmir in 1947. Well, that is the Indian view, and it leaves out a whole lot of inconvenient facts. The Kashmiri Muslims regarded October 27th, not 22nd, as Black Day, because Indian forces entered Kashmir under dubious circumstances, which time does not permit me to cover. But, of course, there are 900,000 Indian troops in India controlling 9 million Kashmiris in a brutal occupation. I was going to read out some figures, but to discuss the issue of stolen money in foreign banks' accounts and also the issue of Kashmir, here is Prime Minister Imran Khan making a sincere appeal for justice. Listen to this clip.
Mr. President, because of the plunder of the developing world by their corrupt ruling elites, the gap between the rich and the poor countries is increasing at an alarming speed. Through this platform, I've been drawing the world's attention towards the scourge of illicit financial flows from developing countries. The Secretary General's high-level panel of financial accountability, transparency and integrity, called the FACTI panel, has calculated that a staggering $7 trillion in stolen assets are parked in financial haven destinations. This organized theft and illegal transfer of assets has profound consequences for the developing nations. It depletes their already meager resources, accentuates the levels of poverty, especially when laundered money puts pressure on the currency and leads to its devaluation. At the current rate, when the FACTI panel estimates that $1 trillion every year is taken out of the developing world, there will be a mass exodus of economic migrants towards the richer nations. What the East India Company did to India, the crooked ruling elites are doing to the developing world, plundering the wealth and transferring it to Western capitals and offshore tax havens. And Mr. President, retrieving the stolen assets from the developed countries is impossible for poor nations. The rich countries have no incentives or compulsion to return this ill-gotten wealth. And this ill-gotten wealth belongs, remember, to the masses of the developing world. I foresee in the not too distant future, a time will come when the rich countries will be forced to build walls to keep out economic migrants from these poor countries. I fear a few wealthy islands in the sea of poverty will also turn into a global calamity like climate change. The General Assembly must take steps meaningfully to address this deeply disturbing and morally repugnant situation. Naming and shaming the haven destinations and developing a comprehensive legal framework to halt and reverse the illicit financial flows are most critical actions to stop this great economic injustice. And at a minimum, the recommendations of the Secretary General's FACTI panel should be fully implemented. Mr. President, Islamophobia is another pernicious phenomena that we all need to collectively combat. In the aftermath of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, terrorism has been associated with Islam by some quarters. This has increased the tendency of right-wing, xenophobic and violent nationalist extremists and terrorist groups to target Muslims. The UN Global Counter-Terrorism Strategy has recognized these emerging threats. We hope the Secretary General's report will focus on these new threats of terrorism posed by Islamophobes and right-wing extremists. I call on the Secretary General to convene a global dialogue on countering the rise of Islamophobia. Our parallel efforts at the same time should be to promote interfaith harmony, and they should continue. Mr. President, the worst and most pervasive form of Islamophobia now rules India. The hate-filled Hindutva ideology propagated by the fascist RSS-BJP regime has unleashed a reign of fear and violence against India's 200 million Muslim strong community. Mob lynching by car vigilantes, frequent pogroms such as the one in New Delhi last year, discriminatory citizenship laws to purge India of Muslims, and a campaign to destroy mosques across India and obliterate its Muslim heritage and history are all part of this criminal enterprise. New Delhi has also embarked on what it ominously calls the final solution for Jammu and Kashmir dispute. It has undertaken a series of illegal and unilateral measures in occupied Jammu and Kashmir since 5th August 2019. It has unleashed a reign of terror by an occupation force of 900,000. It has jailed senior Kashmiri leadership, imposed a clampdown on media and internet, violently suppressed peaceful protest, abducted 13,000 young Kashmiris and tortured hundreds of them. It has extrajudicially killed hundreds of innocent Kashmiris in fake encounters and imposed collective punishments by destroying entire neighborhoods and villages. We had unveiled a detailed dossier on gross and systematic violations of human rights by the Indian security forces in occupied Jammu and Kashmir. This repression is accompanied by illegal efforts to change the demographic structure of the occupied territory and transform it from a Muslim majority into a Muslim minority. Indian actions violate the resolutions of the United Nations Security Council on Jammu and Kashmir. They clearly prescribe, the resolutions clearly prescribe that the final disposition of the disputed territory should be decided by its people through a free and impartial plebiscite held under the UN auspices. India's action in occupied Jammu and Kashmir also violate international human rights and humanitarian laws, including the Fourth Geneva Convention, and amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. It is unfortunate, very unfortunate, that the world's approach to violations of human rights lack even-handedness and even are selective. Geopolitical considerations or corporate interests, commercial interests, often compel major powers to overlook the transgressions of their affiliated countries. Such double standards, and the most glaring in case of India, where this RSS BJP regime is being allowed to get away with human rights abuses with complete immunity. The most recent example of Indian barbarity was the forcible snatching of the mortal remains of the great Kashmiri leader, Sayyid Ali Shah Gilani, from his family, denying him a proper Islamic funeral and burial in accordance with his wishes and the Muslim tradition. Devoid of any legal or moral sanction, this action has been against the basic norms of human decency. I call on this General Assembly to demand that Sayyid Gilani's mortal remains be allowed to be buried in the Cemetery of Martyrs with the appropriate Islamic rites. Mr. President, Pakistan desires peace with India as with all its neighbors, but sustainable peace in South Asia is contingent upon resolution of the Jammu and Kashmir dispute in accordance with the relevant United Nations Security Council resolutions and the wishes of the Kashmiri people. Last February, we reaffirmed the 2003 ceasefire understanding along the line of control. The hope was that it would lead to a rethink of the strategy in Delhi. Sadly, the BJP government has intensified repression in Kashmir and continues to vitiate the environment by these barbaric acts. The onus remains on India to create a conducive environment for meaningful and result-oriented engagement with Pakistan. And for that, it must do, number one, reverse its unilateral and illegal measures instituted since 5th August 2019. Secondly, stop its oppression and human rights violations against the people of Kashmir. And three, halt and reverse the demographic changes in the occupied territory. It is also essential to prevent another conflict between Pakistan and India. India's military buildup, development of advanced nuclear weapons, and acquisition of destabilizing conventional capabilities can erode mutual deterrence between the two countries.
Well, there you are, folks. Imran Khan, a plea from the heart, speaking about a very sad situation. And that sad note brings me to another very, very sad occurrence and event. I can't even start to imagine what the parents of the Moti boys must be going through. The hell, the nightmare that they are experiencing. Absolutely devastating. And, of course, what the boys must be experiencing. The only thing I can say is that may Allah make it easy for them. May the boys return safely and may they not be permanently affected by this extreme trauma. Well, dear listeners, we've run out of time. In fact, I've gone over time. And that's all I have for you today. And yes, can't end without the customary light at the end of the tunnel. Right, so let's look at the graveyard of the light at the end of the tunnel in 1 minute. We all are living in very stressful times, okay? Stressful times. And Chota Mota went to the doctor for a checkup, and after examining him, the doctor asked, "So what do you do when you feel stressed?" And Chota Mota replied, I go to the masjid. And the doctor said, Mashallah, that is so wonderful. Do you go there and sit and read and meditate? And Chota Mota replied, No, doctor. I mix up all the shoes outside and watch people more stressed than me, and my stress goes away. Okay, here's a quick one. You know, I was earlier speaking about true love and romance and so on. A wife, being the romantic type, sent her husband a WhatsApp message. This is what it said. If you are sleeping, send me your dreams. If you are laughing, send me your smile. If you are eating, send me a bite. If you are drinking, send me a sip. If you are crying, send me your tears. I love you. And the husband, like most husbands, is not the romantic type. And he replied, I am on the toilet. Please advise. This is A.B. Dawji bidding you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.